This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
The question was, what are we going to do with the indictees, namely Al-Bashir, Abdul-Rahim, Ahmed Kosheb, and the four indictees?
That's Ahmed Tugud Lisan, the chief negotiator for the Darfur Justice and Equality Movement, on Sudan's government agreeing to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court. Details coming up. Also, vote counting in Cameroon's local and parliamentary elections on Sunday has been marred by violence. And the founder of South Africa's music group Ladysmith Black Mambozo, Joseph Shabalala, has died at age 78. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, the chief negotiator for the Darfur Justice and Equality Movement, one of the warring groups in Sudan's long civil war, says the Khartoum government has agreed to hand over former President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court. Ahmed Tugud Lisan, the chief negotiator of the Darfur Justice and Equality Movement's opposition group, told VOA's English to Africa service that all four former Sudanese officials under Sisi indictment will be handed over for trial. However, Sudanese government officials have not specifically named Bashir as one of those who will be handed over. A government official said that all charged with crimes in Darfur will be sent to the ICC. Bashir is one of the four. Lisan spoke with VOA's Jason Patinkin.
It seems as though the government of Sudan and the rebels have agreed to hand Omar al-Bashir, the former president, and the other ICC indictees over to the ICC. Is that correct?
Yes, it's correct. We have been discussing with the government of Sudan a number of issues relating to the Darfur conflict. One of those issues was the issue of justice, reconciliation, and accountability relating to the violations that took place in Darfur. And within the context of justice and reconciliation, we discussed a number of options, including the mechanisms to achieve justice and also to redress the victims of the conflict in Darfur. And the question was, what are we going to do with the indictees, namely Al-Bashir, Abdul-Rahim, Ahmed Kosheb, and the four indictees. So the four indictees, basically, we agreed that the government of Sudan should fully and unlimitedly cooperate with the International Criminal Court in order to hand over those indictees to the ICC, and also to abide by the fully abide by the requirements of the resolution 1591, which referred the situation of Darfur to the International Criminal Court. So, and this is basically relating to the those who already indicted by the ICC, but the other people who are in a large number of perpetrators who committed crimes in Darfur, we agreed to establish a special criminal court in order to deal with the issue of justice and accountability. And we are going to establish this court immediately after we signed the peace agreement and we go to Sudan.
And so has this agreement been signed? Has it been signed that will send these four men to the ICC?
Well, this this is one of the papers, because we are looking for different papers, and this is the one of the protocols. This is a protocol of justice and reconciliation and accountability. But at the end, we are going to sign within the context of a comprehensive peace agreement, including number of protocols and the justice and equality and justice and accountability is one of the protocols that we are going to sign, which takes the responsibility of the parties to hand over the indictees to ICC.
Okay, so once the full peace agreement is signed, then this will go into effect. But until then, it is an agreement, but it won't be implemented until the full agreement is made, the full peace agreement.
Definitely, yes. We agreed initially that this is the text. And now we are moving to discuss the other issues or the other protocols. As soon as we finish the protocols, we are going to sign a comprehensive peace agreement. And in that peace agreement, we are going to specify which date this agreement will come into effect and which date then the mechanisms that need to be operate. So basically, this agreement is not going to be implemented immediately, rather than when we sign the final peace agreements, which are expecting it in the coming few weeks.
The International Criminal Court indicted Bashir on 5 counts of crimes against humanity, including murder, forcible transfer, torture, and rape. He also is charged with 2 counts of war crimes, including intentionally directing attacks against civilians and pillaging, and 3 counts of genocide against the 4 Masalit and Zagwa groups. Bashir took power in a 1989 coup and proceeded to escalate an ongoing civil war in southern Sudan. The conflict spread to the Darfur region in the early 2000s. In 2005, he signed a peace deal with southern Sudanese rebels, eventually allowing for South Sudan's 2011 secession. But Bashir's government continued to support rebel groups in South Sudan. Though the ICC issued a warrant for al-Bashir's arrest in 2009, he was never apprehended despite traveling abroad several times. He was deposed in a military coup in April last year after months of nationwide protests against his rule and jailed in the country's notorious Kober prison, where many of those arrested by his government had been locked up and tortured. Last year, a Sudanese court convicted him of corruption and sentenced him to 2 years in a prison for elderly convicts. The 3 other ICC indictees from Sudan's government are former Interior Minister Ahmed Mohamed Haroun, Ali Muhammad Ali Abdel Al-Rahman, also known as Al-Kushaib, who was a senior commander of the Janjaweed militia that carried out many of the attacks in Darfur, and Abdel Rahim Mohamed Hussein, who formerly served as Defense Minister, Interior Minister, and Special Presidential Representative in Darfur. Vote counting in Cameroon's local and parliamentary elections on Sunday has been marred by violence and opposition claims of fraud committed by the ruling party. Opposition leaders accusing the ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement of ballot stuffing, which it denies. Moke Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Opposition candidates and officials of Cameroon's elections management body ELECAM argued at a polling station Monday in the southwestern town of Limbe. As vote counting continued in Sunday's local and parliamentary elections, some parts of Cameroon saw protests sparked by allegations of fraud. Frix Ngeka Etoke is an opposition Social Democratic Front candidate for parliament. He accuses President Paul Biya's ruling Cameroon People's Democratic Movement, CPDM party, and election officials of rigging the vote.
It's a shame. The International Committee to see, we caught one lady with about 500 CPDM ballot papers. This one case, the president of a police station has stuffed the box. Is it not a pity?
Etoke alleged the CPDM also declared itself the winner in English-speaking villages where civilians fled fighting between the military and rebels, despite no one voting. Local ruling party officials dismissed the fraud allegations as unfounded. The government, however, acknowledged fraud allegations and election disputes in almost every town where the opposition fielded a candidate. Disgruntled opposition supporters blocked traffic in several western towns, and some protests against the alleged fraud turned violent. The governor of the French-speaking western region, Augustin Awafonka, says clashes in one village left one man dead and several wounded. He would not identify the man or give details on how he was killed, but called for a return to peace.
There is no point for people coming out, blocking the roads, quarreling, fighting. Violent acts here and there are unnecessary. So I'm calling on the population to be calm, vigilant. They should avoid provocations. And if we don't succeed today, it is not the end of the world. You prepare for the next elections. I think at this point in time, we badly need peace.
The government deployed the military to English-speaking towns to protect voters from insurgents who had vowed to disrupt the polls. But some villagers who talked to reporters accused the military of using the deployment to have troops cast multiple votes for the ruling party. The Minister of Territorial Administration, Paul Atanganji, rejected the claims. He insists the polls were fair and successful, despite what he described as a few challenges.
All went well in the 24,988 polling stations. Any form of challenge to the verdict of the polls other than the constitutional legal means will not be tolerated.
The ruling CPDM party is calling on its supporters and all Cameroonians to wait calmly for official election results. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Ethiopia's 100 million citizens are seeing unprecedented political change as Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed has freed journalists and activists, lifted bans on political parties, and prosecuted officials accused of gross human rights abuses. But reports from human rights organizations such as Amnesty International point to a sharp increase in lawlessness that could undermine national elections. Opposition politicians are already warning against any delay the elections due in August 2020. These elections would be the first under Abiy, but are under threat from an explosion of regional ethnic rivalries. To get a better understanding about what's going on, I talked to Ahmed Soliman, researcher on the Horn of Africa with the Africa program at Chatham House.
There are many different reasons why Ethiopia's readiness for the elections can be deemed to be, it's not there. But if we don't hold these elections, or if we don't enable these more open elections that take place this time around, then there's a precedent or the excuse for not doing so in future will have been set. So that's, you know, something he said from the outset. I think, you know, there will be pressure from a number of groups. If there were to be discussions around another postponement of the elections, because that brings its own problems, given the constitutional issues and staunch opposition from certain parties such as the TPLF, you know, who are obviously no longer a part of the governing coalition, as it were, and to any others who want to kind of go beyond this constitutional schedule. So I think there's a very, you know, difficult question here around the elections and a lot of uncertainty around it. Again, the security situation, the electoral preparedness, and, you know, the nature now, given the kind of dramatic and continuous political shifts, including with the establishment of the Prosperity Party, about what the elections entail, you know, the competition that's likely to take place around those. I think, you know, we're in this context of that divide that we talked about between supporters of the ethnic federal system and guaranteeing regional self-rule, and those who want to see more of a unitary system. and think that, you know, the growing ethnic segregation leads to growing animosity and might lead to the disintegration of the Ethiopian state. So there are extreme positions, and I think what I'm saying is there needs to be more of a kind of a centrist view about the way forward for Ethiopia.
Would you say postponing the national vote would cause an adverse social reaction, further fueling regional conflicts and damaging Abiy's democratic credentials?
What we don't know is what the position of the new party, the Prosperity Party, is with regards to ethno-nationalism and federalism in the country. It's still, I think, a bit up in the air and uncertain whether we're looking at a party that wishes to strengthen centrist rule or one where, you know, there will be greater or a kind of move towards a system of greater rule for the regions and empowerment for ethno-nationalists. But of course, they have committed to multinational federalism, I think. But we're still, I think, a little bit unsure as to what the party stands for in that regard. You know, I think, as you mentioned in the outset, that there has been a lot achieved since 2018 by the new government, by the prime minister, but it really does need to be built on. And, you know, now seems to be a very now seems to be an even more crucial time building up to these elections to try and focus internally on some of these challenges. Prime minister has been able to, I think, focus on his vision of unity and democracy in the future of the country. But the kind of today's issues, the pertinent issues that we talk about, including this debate around ethno-nationalism, I think needs to be adequately addressed. And the role of the federal government, in, I think, mediating here at this time is very important. I don't think it can be overstated. And it needs to be an actor that is seen as legitimate in mediating these issues. And I guess incentivize the de-escalation of any of the tensions between, you know, regional actors and regional and between the regions themselves. So I think that's very important.
That was Ahmed Soliman, researcher on the Horn of Africa with the Africa program at Chatham House. He was speaking with me from London. Kenyans and African leaders streamed into Nyayo National Stadium today to attend the funeral of Daniel Arap Moi, Kenya's second president, who died last Tuesday while undergoing treatment at a Nairobi hospital. Kenyans remembered Moi in different ways in a ceremony that seemed to have brought the country together. Rael Ambor reports from Nairobi.
Thousands of Kenyans streamed into Nyayo National Stadium on Tuesday to attend the funeral for Kenya's former president, Daniel Arap Moi. The youngest of Moi's sons, Gideon Moi, led the nation in eulogizing his father.
This was our father, an elephantine memory and a compassionate heart. Throughout his years of service, he taught us to have tough feet but keep a soft heart. Our father was a forgiving man.
Several heads of state present eulogized the former president as a Pan-Africanist who contributed significantly to the unity of the continent. Saleh Wak Zewde, Ethiopia's president, was among the regional leaders present.
We will always remember the fundamental role that he has played in the formation of our regional organization, IGAD, back in 1986, but also the contribution that he has made in the revitalization of IGAD in 1996 while he was heading the organization. The role that he has played both in Sudan to bring peace between Sudan and South Sudan as well in Somalia are also big achievements that this region has registered.
South Sudan President Salva Kiir talked about how Moi was instrumental in the birth of his country by playing a significant role in the Comprehensive Peace Agreement with Khartoum in 2005.
As the President of the Republic of South Sudan is the product of his work and will remain his legacy. My people very much respect and honor late President Daniel Arap Moi.
Daniel Arap Moi took over Kenya's presidency upon the death of the country's first president, Jomo Kenyatta, in 1978 and ruled until 2002. Moi was accused of serious rights violations, including torture and political killings. For this, he faced local and international criticism. One of those tortured was Kenya's former Prime Minister Raila Odinga, who nevertheless eulogized Moi as a great leader.
He also made some mistakes. I was, for example, one of the victims. But he was also forgiving, like I'm also forgiving. And we made our peace, and we shook hands, and then worked together to give this country a new constitution. So we want to remember him for the good things that he did, which we want to carry forward as we move to try to unite our country, bring it together.
Herman Manyora, a political analyst based in Nairobi, said that the president led the country at a critical time, the Cold War era, when the push and pull between Western and communist interests made other neighboring countries collapse.
Weighing the bad things people talk about against the great things he did, I think you could give him 70%. You know, he was president at a time when there was turmoil in Africa.
Moi was 95. His burial is scheduled for Wednesday. Rael Ombur, for VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. President Donald Trump's administration is proposing a steep 21% cut in aid the United States provides to foreign countries, with a budget request of $44.1 billion for such programs, compared with $55.7 billion for the current fiscal year. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman has the details.
The acting director of the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, Russ Vogt, says it's time for the United States to rethink how it does foreign aid.
We need to move beyond the reality of spending money for the Bob Dylan statue in Mozambique, or the NASA space camp in Pakistan, or the Professional Cricket League in Afghanistan.
The president's budget needs to be approved by lawmakers. The chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Elliot Engel, tweeted a photo of a trash receptacle, indicating the expected destination for the spending proposals when they arrive on Capitol Hill. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
The founder of South African multi-Grammy award-winning music group Ladysmith Black Mambaza, Joseph Shabalala, has died at age 78. AP reports Shabalala died this morning at a hospital in the capital, Pretoria. He is world known for his leadership of the choral group founded in 1964 that shot to world acclaim, collaborating with Paul Simon on the Graceland album and others. Shabalala founded the prolific group in the small town of Ladysmith along the east coast of South Africa at the height of white minority apartheid rule. The haunting, often a cappella singing style known as Isikitamiya, helped the Grammy Award-winning group become one of South Africa's most recognized performers on world stage. Shabalala retired from Ladysmith Black Mambaza in 2014, but made occasional appearances at its events. He has been hospitalized several times since 2017. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington. We close today's show with the song Homeless, Ladysmith Black Mambaza, performed with Paul Simon.
Homeless, homeless, moonlight street, you wanna midnight lake. Homeless, homeless, moonlight street, you wanna midnight lake. Homeless,
we are
homeless, the moonlight street, you wanna midnight lake.
We are
homeless,
homeless,
homeless, the moonlight street, you wanna midnight lake.
See you.